Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Vietnam Innovators. You might be noticing we're in a different set today. For those of you on the video version of this podcast, we're here at Tech Spaces here at Hanoi, one of my favorite coffee shops and multifunctional spaces. Check them out. We're here with a special guest. His name is Coast. He is a climate change environment expert. I don't know if that's the best way to put it. I'll let him explain in just a little bit. He's our first guest as part of a special series that we're doing with the Netherlands mission to Vietnam called the Orange Lotus. It's in celebration of the 50-year anniversary of diplomatic relations between Vietnam and the Netherlands, a very special occasion. And we're happy to kind of mark that anniversary here at Vietcetera on the Vietnam Innovators podcast with the Orange Lotus. Coast, welcome to the show. I understand your kids know about Vietcetera. You do as well. No stranger. Hopefully your kids are listening. They can be proud of their father. But also, more importantly, let's talk about what you know about, which is climate change, the environment, protecting the environment, making the most out of it. It's not just protection. It's about growing the economy as well. Coast, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd love to hear more about yourself and what you're doing in Vietnam. And of course, I understand you speak Vietnamese, which is probably better than my Vietnamese, so maybe you can start there.
Yeah. Ok, anh tự giới thiệu. Vì anh ở Việt Nam từ rất lâu rồi, 23 năm rồi, và đến Việt Nam lần đầu tiên là năm 93. Anh là người Hà Lan, sinh ra một làng nhỏ Tây Bắc ở Hà Lan. Bên mẹ là có nhiều người nông dân và có con bò và sữa, và mẹ là cô gái Hà Lan thật. Bên bố là có nhiều nông dân cũng thế, mà trồng hoa tulip và khoai tây vân vân. That's an introduction to show you that I am a very, very typical Dutchman. I was born below mean sea level, under the sea, in a very low part of the country. I studied at Wageningen University, agriculture university, but my focus was on irrigation, tuilet, and land management, climate change, or I should say meteorology. Just to continue with my brief introduction is that I worked in more than 30 countries over my working life, so let's say almost 40 years.
Okay.
I have spent not only 23 years in Vietnam, but I spent a couple of years in Africa. I was in Bangladesh. I was in Latin America for shorter periods of time, and many, many places in Asia and Africa. All of which was about water management. It was about climate change. It was about disaster management related to water. It was about helping poor people, and it was about some sense of, help the developing countries, help the third world. Back to Vietnam, you need to realize that in my generation, I watched TV in the 1960s and early 70s, and so Vietnam was on the TV every day for very bad reasons. And so to find it, to find myself here is a very positive experience.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Vietnam has transformed not just since the 60s, but since you arrived in the 90s, 20-something years in Vietnam now. In the context of your work, which is about water management, climate change, making sure that the communities that you are serving as an expert keep up with the times, let's put it that way, what has Vietnam done at a high level in collaboration with the Netherlands, perhaps, and the company that you represent and all that? What does the outlook look like for the next, let's say, 5 to 10, 15 years in response to water management, if you were to summarize in 60 seconds?
Water management is a massive challenge in Vietnam because of climate change, in addition to something that was already difficult for the entire history of Vietnam. Whether you look at the Red River Delta or the Mekong Delta, or you look at the uplands where water is a challenge too, or the Central Coast region. So climate change is making it a lot worse, a lot more challenging. The same is true for upstream river development. So Mekong Delta in particular is affected by what happens in the entire river basin, in the other countries, neighboring countries. And so the outlook, it is that Vietnam has to continue to invest in a constant process of change, adaptation, we call it, to this new reality. And of course, at the same time, it needs to continue to grow. These people need to continue to develop in social economic terms and not consider this to be an impossibility at all. But adaptation is going to be a feature of Vietnam in the water sort of environment for centuries to come.
Let's talk about the different types of water. Let's dive a little deeper, to use a bit of a pun there. I'm not super familiar with this space. I mean, maybe a little bit more than the average person, but for those of you listening, there's lots of different types of water management. We talk about the sea levels, you know, drawing from the Netherlands experience, being very close to the water, the Atlantic Ocean, the English Channel, where the land is lower than the sea. Now, in the context of Vietnam, you have that challenge, especially in the southern part of the region, where water levels are beginning to rise rapidly. But you also talk about agriculture water management, where in the Mekong Delta, where I imagine the majority of Vietnam's agricultural resources Correct. Are contributing to you know, fighting hunger or just feeding the population, that's at threat. So in a few pillars, maybe you can share about what types of water management are you looking at in Vietnam and that everyday people should be thinking about?
In my work, I focus on, as I call it, irrigation. So this is really about agriculture and water. But if I talk about my climate change work, I have to consider all kinds of purposes of water, just like what you're saying now. Whether it's transport, the sea, inland water transport, drinking water supply at small scale and at large scale for cities and for villages and for individual households, and agriculture. Now, Vietnam is facing some very major challenges. Examples are found everywhere. In the Mekong Delta, you have a process whereby a lot of farmers and drinking water companies and so on, they take water from underground layers. That causes subsidence of parts of the Mekong Delta. In Ho Chi Minh City, similar process is happening, and even at a higher rate. This means that lots of parts of the country will ultimately become, like the Netherlands, below mean sea level or even below absolute sea level. Now, what has happened in the Netherlands as well as in the last 20, 30 years in Vietnam is you saw a shift as to what we think we are doing. So in the Netherlands, the history is one of control of water, of absolute control of water. Keep it out. Water is a problem. And that approach started to change in the late 1980s, early 1990s, where people more and more talked about living with water, allowing salt water in certain parts of the land, for example. Vietnam, the same. The shift in concept in Vietnam is also very noticeable in policies and investments. So in, again, the Mekong Delta, together with the Netherlands, the Vietnamese experts have started to talk about living with water, living with salinity where possible. It doesn't mean that they want to swim all the time, and I'm also not a fish. I did not swim all the time in the village where I grew up. So yes, we control it, but also we need to work with the reality, with nature, with the certainty of a future with higher sea levels, with more salinity, and so on and so forth.
I had a recent discussion with a healthcare expert, a global one, CEO of a pharmaceutical company visiting from Europe over to Vietnam was on my show, and she was talking about the difference between, in healthcare terms, which I very much relate to what you're discussing now, which is the idea of treatment versus self-care.
That's right.
Meaning treatment is like you get sick and then you treat, whereas self-care is meaning you maintain your health so that you prevent sickness in the first place. Does that analogy kind of relate here in the sense that we know that water is a problem, but also an opportunity that if we're proactive, we self-care, we don't have to treat later. Is that?
Very much true, very similar. So concepts in Vietnam have changed partly because of an interaction with the Dutch experience. I would say the more recent Dutch experience. And yes, climate change or sea level rise adaptation is about at least partially living with and not fighting it. And living with can mean that you adapt your crops to the reality of different types of water, or you shift to aquaculture where you used to grow freshwater rice, etc., etc. You also need to consider shifting where people live. You know, you cannot continue in the same living patterns if water levels are very high. So this reality is there, but then you can find ways of doing so. And that's already happening in the Mekong Delta. It's also already happening in other parts of Vietnam.
I've got a question for you. You mentioned that people have to adapt in addition to caring about the current situation. Yeah. Of course, experts, the Vietnamese who are coming to the Netherlands, bringing that expertise back, experts like you that are coming here working bilaterally, that's at the very high level, that's at the expert level. Do the ordinary people living in the Mekong Delta, the farmers, the ones that are impacted at the end of the day, the people living there, do they understand the threats that are posed to them?
I think the people living it understand the threats better than the people studying it. This is true all over the world. The problem with the current change is that the scientists know better about the future. But the reality of today, people experience it and they know it. This has a huge advantage for the change process. Because if you tap into that knowledge, into that awareness, you can perhaps jointly come with solutions. And I've seen that happening in Chaving province, for example, where with government and international support, all kinds of new, what we call livelihood models were developed. Mm. New crops, new varieties, new fish breeds mixed with crops, or all kinds of things like that. And that's very promising. And people can make a living out of that. And if you do that as what I call a scientist working with a farmer or a farming household, you have a very much bigger chance of success. Because they know not only the reality of, let's call it, the climate or weather change or water change, they also know the market. They also know, you know, what you need to buy, what you need to sell in order to make a living. So I'm very, very enthusiastic about those experiences where the experts manage to work with the population.
Fantastic.
And it's happening, and it's happening, and it is delivering some concrete results in my experience.
With more than half of the population living below sea level, the Netherlands has a 17,000-kilometer network of dams, dikes, and sluices protecting the population from flooding. Over the centuries, the Dutch have repeatedly created new land in the sea. The Delta and Zuider Zee Works, considered as one of the seven wonders of the modern world, keep our feet dry. Today's projects incorporate innovative functions, such as sustainable power generation built into safety structures. As a result, the Netherlands has not suffered a major catastrophe due to flooding in 70 years. More than eight centuries of water management have taught us that knowledge institutions, businesses, government, and local stakeholders need to work closely together around societal challenges. An integrated approach has resulted in the high flood defense safety standards of the Netherlands. Careful monitoring and maintenance are essential components of smart asset management.
Let's talk about the intersection now of the other parties involved in this whole equation, which include governance, which include finance, money. Where does that all fit into the equation? Is there enough public and private sector interest to support the academics, the experts, the people living on the land? Mm. Where does that fit into the equation, in your opinion?
Let me give you an example about my own company in the Mekong Delta in An Giang, together with some others, meaning the authorities and NGO and businesses. I have invested in a very small system whereby solar panels are put on top of a greenhouse in order to generate electricity. That electricity is used partially locally, and it is partially sold to the electricity company. Now, that greenhouse has been made relatively high. It's roughly four meters above the ground. That means it doesn't take away all the light. On the side, light can still come in. We can put nets. And the farmer can still grow crops there. And what we have found, with researchers also continuing to research this, is that actually the crop, the products, the cucumbers or the zalmuang or whatever, are actually growing better inside this space compared to outside. So here you see a modern technology, solar power, combined with fairly traditional crop cultivation, vegetables in particular, and co-benefits. meaning both the farmers' crop are better and the electricity is generated, which is green, clean energy.
We talked a lot about a lot of good things today. We've talked about the opportunities, what's already being done, the excitement around from both sides, private, public, everything, about this very big challenge to Vietnam's future and the Netherlands' future. Let's talk about the challenges, though, themselves. I'm sure there's a few things that you got the big checkbox that are like, we need to get this checked off. It's not quite there yet. What are those exactly that you could highlight so that the stakeholders can understand quickly on this podcast what those are so that they become opportunities, not just ongoing challenges?
One of the challenges, let me not make the list too long because that will get very boring.
Not too overwhelming, yeah.
One of the challenges relates to, for example, riverbank erosion, coastal erosion, and that means collapse of people's houses or roads or other infrastructure. It also means, you know, trouble for not just the individual, but for communities and even whole provinces. And it's considered to be a very urgent or permanent issue in different parts of Vietnam. What can be done there? And what is being tried out or done? This is what we call a number of nature-based solutions. So you need to imagine a strengthening of mangrove forest along the coast, maybe interspersed with aquaculture or, you know, shrimp farms or something like that, but in such a manner that coastal protection improves, that we do not repeat the disasters of the past, that we protect better despite sea level rise and all these other challenges. Similarly, you can look at big river banks that need to be protected. You can do that with concrete and a lot of steel, which is very expensive and actually is not always permanent. Needs to be maintained, needs to be maybe made bigger after some years. Instead, you can also look at green solutions to that. You know, you can do all kinds of mixtures of materials. You can combine that with trees, plants, shrubs. That requires policy changes. That requires sometimes even moving people away from the riverbank.
That's not easy.
Which is not easy. It's also not cheap. People will need compensation or something like that. But it ultimately could benefit those people as well as the wider community and so on and so forth. And these kinds of solutions that are being tried out are also, they are not existing. Some of these solutions are still being tried out, meaning they're being developed. Again, in the Netherlands, you see some of these experiences and some of them are being modified, transplanted, I couldn't say, but modified for application along coastal zones or riverbanks in Vietnam. So lots of challenges. This is one example. I believe one other needs to be mentioned, which is that in Vietnam, you already see some coastal zones where farmers are growing things like seaweed. Basically, that's a weed that grows in the sea and you can use it for food. You can, it is already being used for food in Vietnam, but also in Korea, in Japan, where we know this very much from their kitchens. In the Netherlands, there are also developments with growing all kinds of things in the sea, plants. There are many potential applications for this, and there are many, let's call it, developments in that space happening. So again, a collaboration between the two countries could help certain individual farmers and maybe even a whole new sector to come up.
Very good.
And in future, we need to get food, and maybe that's not the same food as we used to eat in the past.
I'm going to share some pretty big numbers here that will hopefully help our audience understand the scale of this. So in the Mekong Delta, where a lot of these challenges are happening, it's a water source for nearly 65 million people, and including over 17 million in Vietnam. So this is not just a Vietnam problem.
Correct.
It's an Indo-Southeast Asian problem. It contributes a lot to the economy as well. That is now potentially at risk. What is that impact over the next decade if we're not doing enough? What is that scale of?
I think the scale of the whole of the river basin, which is what you're talking about, including the Mekong Delta, is global, meaning it is one of the biggest rivers of the world. It is very significant.
Coast, I want to kind of make it a bit relatable to the everyday people that have visited or live in the Mekong Delta. We have some interesting statistics behind that. Not only do a lot of people live there, It's a water source for 65 million people, including over 17 million in Vietnam. So it's not just a Vietnam problem, it's the neighbors surrounding us as well. And of course, the economy, it's powered by a lot of the agriculture that's made out of that region. What's that impact on the livelihood, on the economy, if climate change does impact the Mekong Delta in the way that you're expecting it to?
These numbers are big, but the reality is that it is even more important than that. The Mekong River is one of the biggest rivers in the world. The Mekong Delta does not just produce for 17 million people. Actually, it is the biggest granary in Vietnam. It produces fruit, fish, aquaculture, and rice, also for export. And for national consumption, meaning well beyond the Mekong Delta itself. So national food security and international export. And that's just the Delta. The same is true for other parts of this river basin, meaning in Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand, China, Myanmar. So the significance is massive. The climate change that I've spoken about occurs in different forms. It's different in different parts of the Mekong River basin. So there's more drought, more rainfall at different times. There is salinity in the Vietnam and also in the Vietnam Mekong Delta. But there is also in Vietnam drought. There is also extreme rainfall in what is Vietnam's part of the Mekong River basin. So these challenges have to be dealt with. And they can be, but not easily for everything. So for example, in the upstream of the river, lots of river basin, you know, tributaries as well as the mainstream river, they are building big dams for hydropower generation. Now, hydropower is relatively green, so that's a great thing for the world. You know, reduce greenhouse gas emissions and so on and so forth. But it also causes problem for biodiversity. It causes problem for Vietnam in terms of reduced water at certain times in the year, reduced sediment coming down the river for Vietnam, again, a major issue. So this needs to be managed. That requires a lot of international cooperation to make that, let's call it useful and possible. So there are international challenges that are I'm only cautiously positive about. You know, it is not all about living with water in the Mekong Delta and with some salinity. There are problems that require solutions. And that includes a lack of water. At the wrong time of the year, the dam closed means that, you know, farmers, not just in Vietnam, can't grow a crop. We need to be cautious on that one. Significance is huge. It requires, therefore, huge, not just diplomatic relations, but investments to enable, to reduce the problems and to enable alternatives for people around the whole of the river. So not only in the Mekong Delta.
Coast, you've been here 23 years in Vietnam. You represent the Dutch people in a way. That's almost half of the 50 years of relations between the two countries. How do you see the next 50 evolving in the context of your work?
Well, I would start by saying, unfortunately, I will not be around for another 50 years, so so I can dream. I think about the relationship, I'm very confident that it is, because of so many opportunities, it is going to deepen. And that will be at the level of technology exchanges, knowledge exchanges, university and other knowledge centers. It will be at the business level, we discussed already, and government to government. There are very clear interests. And these clear interests, they don't only go back 50 years, actually. I've read a very interesting book about 17th century interactions between Dutch traders and Vietnamese communities and, you know, one particular king of Vietnam, who allegedly also married a half-Dutch lady in the 17th century.
Wow.
She was the number, I think, six concubine of King Lê Thành Tông. And so what that meant then was boosting of trade in Vietnam. And for the Netherlands, there were lots of profits from the trade that they were doing in East Asia and between East Asia and Europe. So there were mutual benefits from this relationship. And I think we will see that in the next 50 years to develop further.
Very good.
And that's not just wishful thinking. There are lots of geopolitical reasons why that is likely. And I believe that, you know, Vietnam being a country that will have to remain important for food production.
Globally.
Globally, for the rest of the world, at least in some part, also into the future. That's a shared feature. The Netherlands is one of the largest agricultural exporters in the world, with lots of problems, but it is a tiny country, and it is exporting a very high volume and value of produce. And I think Vietnam will be in that same league in the future as well.
I'd love to have you provide a quick snapshot about the successful initiatives between the two countries, private and public sector-wise, in your fields. Could you just name one or two from the top of your head that people can kind of imagine, maybe search online right after this?
First, let me talk about water, which is my main topic and my main sort of area. The Netherlands in 1983 had a collaborative effort between my university, where I was studying, and, for example, Kantar University. And that was all about soils and water in the Mekong Delta. In 1993, and one of my professors went there, and that's how I remember it very clearly. In 1993, Dutch consultants worked with Vietnamese experts to develop a master plan on hydrology and irrigation water in the Mekong Delta again. That is massive. I still have it. That's this much paper.
Wow.
In 2013, so 20 years later, another milestone was achieved where between the Netherlands and Vietnam, there was a collaborative committee set up to work on, again, the Mekong Delta, a master plan or Mekong Delta plan for the Mekong Delta. That has continued since 2013 until very recently. Dutch experts have contributed to the Mekong Delta regional planning master plan, which is an integrated plan. That's not just about water. So these are milestones on water, plus a little bit of other stuff. I think other milestones, I don't remember the dates exactly, but it is already true for many years that the Netherlands is a large foreign investor in the private sector in Vietnam, compared to other countries, compared to, I should say, European countries in particular. We need to acknowledge that Japan, Singapore, Korea, they are huge, and China are huge foreign investors in Vietnam. But from a European perspective, the Netherlands has been for many years in the top of the table. That is in multiple sectors, including in particular the food sector, but not only, also in other sectors. So I would call that milestones. I think in terms of government-to-government relations, evidently the diplomatic links started 50 years ago at the not long after reunification of Vietnam. And that is laudable. That relationship stayed at a fairly low level for the first few years, but then started to take off really in the 1990s, when Vietnam started to open up to the world. The Dutch government, as well as businesses and knowledge institutes, jumped on this as an opportunity. And I believe that has only shown growth since then.
What areas should the Netherlands, looking forward, both public and private sectors, prioritize in the context of our discussion today in relation to what's going on in Vietnam right now?
In general terms, I think high tech is a word that springs to mind. It's what Vietnam wants in every sector, not only in agriculture. And in fact, it wants it, you know, literally, let's call it stronger or more than other countries seem to. And the Netherlands has a lot of high tech in many different sectors. And I think that's Vietnam's interest. It's also in the Netherlands' interest to strengthen connections where there is a degree of technology transfer and where there is a degree of technology exchange. So what you can see happening is that some Vietnamese companies, for example, in the IT sector, are starting to export, or they are starting to provide services to companies outside Vietnam. There is a development going on in Vietnam that rapidly is switching from just absorbing foreign technology to starting to contribute to the development of it. And in that sector, that's one example. And so I believe that's, again, potentially of mutual benefit. So not just a one-way street of sharing from the Netherlands to Vietnam.
Coast, we're near the end of our podcast today. Thank you so much for your amazing sharings. I've learned a lot, probably more than I could have in the next, you know, 10 years without Coast today. So thank you so much, Coast, for your sharings. I always like to end the podcast, as you may have listened to the former ones. We have a lot of experts that bring their knowledge about all these different types of industries on the show. We capture it within half an hour. I think in your context, you know a lot about agriculture, water management, climate change. My question for you is, on the next episode of Vietnam Innovators, may it be the special series with the Netherlands Embassy or otherwise, what do you want to know more about? It doesn't have to be in your space of work. Perhaps you're interested about food and beverage, about real estate. What can you share today about your, what's keeping you curious about Vietnam that perhaps we can serve you better and your community? What kind of topic would you like to hear about?
My personal interest is more about what you could call indigenous knowledge. I would be very interested in learning not about, you know, culture and dances of indigenous people in Vietnam, but about knowledge that is perhaps culturally specific of different peoples of Vietnam. I've spoken a lot about the Mekong Delta, where we have a lot of Khmer people, Vietnamese Khmer people living. As you know, there are 54 ethnic groups in Vietnam, many of which in different parts of the country have systems of production, of cultivation, and knowledge linked to those systems. I'm very interested in that. And the particular reason why I'm asking, why I'm expressing that interest, is actually because of the topic I've spoken about, water and agriculture. Because traditional knowledges that are culturally specific often relate to the production of food, to medicine, or to what we can call local medicine, traditional medicine. And these knowledges are disappearing. But at the same time, we need them. We need them in the context of climate change and climate change adaptation. We need them in the context of speeding up the transitions that we need to respond to all the challenges that we can talk about. And I believe there is diversity of knowledge out there that we don't hear very often about.
Yeah, it's about discovering them, unearthing them.
That's right.
What do they know that we don't?
Exactly.
And I think the experts from the Netherlands and also from the universities here in Vietnam, there's stuff that they don't know. And how do we uncover those stories? So thank you so much for sharing, Coast, your curiosity about that topic. We'll try to serve it. It's not going to be easy.
This is difficult.
But I think that's going to pique a lot of interest from our listeners and hopefully from ourselves here today. What excites you about Vietnam?
Food.
What's your favorite experience in Vietnam so far?
Food.
What's your favorite Vietnamese phrase or word that you've learned?
Hồng Biết.
How is climate change impacting Vietnam?
It impacts on everything.
What's the easiest action one can take as an individual to help fight climate change?
Switch off the light when you don't need it.
On a Sunday at 10 a.m., where would you be and what would you be doing?
I would be having a very chilled breakfast with my wife somewhere outside our home.
What should one watch, read, or listen to learn more about climate change in Vietnam?
I forgot the name of the movie, but it is about a meteorite hitting Earth, an American movie.
Okay, that sounds terrible, but good one. Okay, last question. If I was using ChatGPT and I searched Coast, what would it say?
It would probably get you into people from Czech Republic.
Okay, very good. Why is that? Just out of curiosity.
Because of names. Okay. Somehow.
Got it. Everyone, thank you so much for tuning in for another episode of Vietnam Innovators. It's a special series today again, the kickoff one called The Orange Lotus with the Netherlands Mission to Vietnam. It's a special one, 50 years anniversary of diplomatic relations between the two countries. Thank you so much today for kicking off this special series with us. Hopefully we've piqued the curiosity of our audience about water management, agriculture, climate change. And hopefully this is just the beginning. Thank you so much, Coast.
You're most welcome.
Hope to have you maybe a year from now. Let's see the changes related to these efforts. Thank you so much.
I'll be again.
Thank you, guys. See you next time.
You can also check out the video version of this podcast on our other platforms such as YouTube and Facebook. New episodes are out every week. So don't forget to subscribe to Vietcetera's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube channel for more interesting content.